On behalf of Rebuilding Your Life Radio and the Train Your Brain, Claim Your Power calls, welcome. I'm your host, Susan Sciarrico. I'm joined today by Catherine Marini, who is a cardiac nurse and a teacher in Massachusetts. Catherine is the author of the book, The Story of Red Tail Hawk, named in honor of her sister, Amanda Beth Randall. I think she goes by the nickname of Mandy. And Mandy contributed much of this material through her journaling. Mandy was someone who always wanted to fly like a red-tailed hawk, and hence the title. Catherine's sister died after a 10-year addiction to opioids. It was a very difficult journey for the entire family, and one that Catherine shares now in the book. So let's find out a lot more about Catherine's message. Please wave your hand to Catherine to welcome Catherine Marini. Hello, Catherine. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure, madam. Catherine, this must have been a very painful story to write. Who was your sister and what happened to her?
My sister was the youngest of four girls born in 1985, part of the generation that we now know has lost many, many people to this epidemic. We grew up lower to middle class in a time when there was middle class. A lot has changed in the world since then, including childhood. She was the dreamer, the star, the introvert who would go in her room and build these beautiful Barbie dream houses out of Legos and just get lost in her imagination all day long. She could do that day after day after day and be perfectly fine. And then she would come out and emerge as this, you know, vivacious and bubbly person who would just light up the entire room whenever she walked into it. She was the best of friends to all of her friends. She was the baby sister, the baby girl in our family that we all just loved and adored. And she is terribly, terribly missed by everybody who knew her. Everyone that she came in contact with, she left an incredible impact on their life in one way or another. She was very beautiful, inside and out, very smart. Many people told us after she had passed and even during her struggle, because it went on for 10 years, and she was only 29 when she passed. So it was, you know, a third of her life. But many people told us that she was oftentimes the brightest part of their darkest hour, that she would give them her last dollar, her warmest sweatshirt, you know, whatever it was that she had, she was always willing to give someone else. And she gave herself, and she gave herself too much, and she eventually did succumb to this, but not before leaving, luckily, a lot of her thoughts and hopes and dreams and her darkest fears and secrets on paper for us. And we were able to keep a lot of her feelings and emotions and what drove her to keep trying to get better alive by sharing a lot of those poems and those stories.
Now, you mentioned, as I said in my introduction, that she had a 10-year addiction to opioids. How did that happen? Do you know?
She first became addicted to Perc 30s. Those were new at the time. No one really knew anything about them. They were being marketed as non-addictive as well as oxycodone. And, you know, we are here in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and it hit pretty hard and really fast before anybody really understood these drugs or the long-term effects. And most importantly, no one knew how hard they were going to be to quit, because the biggest thing behind them was that they were non-addictive. She tried one at a party, and that was it. And it was like, well, I can do this. Everyone's doing it. It's no big deal. They're not going to change my life. They're not going to ruin my life. I'm still going to have a great life. And she was using heroin within a year.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
It was that fast.
Now, when did you decide you had to tell her story?
So it was about a year after she passed away. I had a box just sitting in my room, of all of her journals and her poems, and she was a wonderful corresponder. She was a very old soul, and she loved to write letters and send cards for everything. She never forgot a birthday, never forgot a holiday, no matter how bad she was in the grips of her addiction at the time or what sober house she was in or rehab center. She always found a way. And we had saved them for a long time. And it had been about a year, and we were just starting to kind of breathe again as a family. It was a tremendous, tremendous loss for us. We really, really kept on to the hope that she was going to be okay, that she was going to get through this, that, you know, this was just going to be a bump in the road, these 10 years. But when we lost her, it changed everything. People tend to think that a loss like that will make a family stronger. It's really hard to stay strong through that because everyone has their own feelings and ways of wanting to deal with it and how they think it should be. I know that for my sisters and myself, we were so concerned about my parents. And then after a while, we almost were like, well, we lost our sister. You know, it was kind of like a back and forth thing. But looking at all that stuff sitting there, I just had this like epiphany one day. I was like, I can't just let her entire life come down to this box in the room. This is not where it was meant to be. Mm-hmm. And on the day that she had passed away, the last conversation we ever had together, because we both used to write back and forth to each other a lot, was she said, promise me that we're going to write that book. Promise me. And she was very serious about it. And I said, yeah, we're going to write a book. And she's like, you promise we're going to write that book. And she had wanted to write a book about everything she had been through.
Mm.
So I decided, you know, I can still write the book, even though she's not here, because she is here. She's in that box. That's her. So I started flipping through it, and I just thought, this details everything that she went through. This is it right here. And I'm just going to write the story from the very beginning, from when she was born, using all of this stuff. And I'm just going to put it out there for everyone. And now she will have written a story. So I listed her as an author. And when you Google her name, her book comes up. So she became what she always wanted to be. And her life now has helped many, and her voice still goes on. And in a way, we feel like she's still here with us. So that's kind of how the whole thing came to be.
Came to be. Well, it seems to me that it's more than just a story about your sister. It's also a cause for you in particular. You're in the nursing field.
Yep.
See this on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah, yes. So that this is also an opportunity for you to take a stand.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. So at the time that she was going through all of this, I was working actually inpatient oncology, and these same medications that were destroying her life were being used by my cancer patients. And I'm like, this is so bizarre because I don't understand. Like, nothing like this had happened, you know, to people in our position before. This was something that maybe you had heard about on the news to other people. But now we're coming into, you know, just regular American families, and we had absolutely no idea what to make of it. And I'm like, this can't even be real. Like, I didn't even know who to talk to or who to ask about it because nothing had ever been like this before. You know, it was just very confusing. But as I'm watching her slowly slip away just in that first year and these behavior changes that were happening, those are things that I think especially parents need to be very aware of, because at the time I was going to my parents who, through no fault of their own, you know, had no idea either. And I'm like, I think there's something going on with her. And they're like, no, you know, she's just a normal teenager. You were like that too. And I'm like, no, I can't put my finger on it, but there's just something not right. And looking back in hindsight, I can tell you it's the little things that when you know someone really well and you know their sleeping patterns and their eating patterns, and then those start to change and little white lies start to come up more and more, and they're not really a big deal. It can seem like you're the one overreacting, but it's happening a lot. It's those little changes that I really hope through reading the story, people can see that is just the beginning. That is just the beginning. And if you feel in your gut like there's something wrong, then you need to take a very firm stance on it.
Now, you You were working with doctors who'd never run into this before, correct?
Correct.
It was something, a new phenomena in medicine. So one of the surprises, I imagine, was that when they felt that, you know, that perhaps this medication was not doing the right thing for this person, that it was actually causing a new problem, that they would stop the prescription with the unintended result that these now addict-created people went out to find drugs wherever they could find them.
And that's exactly what happened, is that, well, we know that 8 out of 12 people started off with a prescription, whether it was a car accident, you know, a procedure, whatever it was. The other people, you know, just thought it was harmless, no big deal. And then they were so quickly addicted to them, so quickly. And I haven't done them, so I can't speak on behalf of what it feels like or how it is. I can only go off of what she told me and what countless patients they have told me, and countless people in meetings and in therapy groups and all that since those days. Because, you know, I want to understand so I can empathize with them. And it's hard to do that when you see people at their worst. As a nurse, when you're taking care of these people because they're inpatients and they can't be at home because it's not safe, withdrawals are extremely dangerous. And people really become someone else, and that's really hard for the family to see too. So it's hard for the patient, hardest for the patient. It's hard for the families, and it's hard for the medical community, and it still is hard. This is still something that has kind of overflowed and had this huge trickle-down effect on mental health, on inpatient beds, on, you know, therapy services, and now we have children and grandchildren being brought up in homes without their parents. So it's affected our society very, very deeply, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. The prescriptions are being tracked a lot more now,
better.
So much more, which is wonderful. And hopefully that will eventually kind of even out some of it.
Some of this, but weren't there places like safe houses available for people to go?
No. You think there's always help somewhere. But what ended up happening, as we learned the hard way, was that, and I do detail a lot of this, because these are really good questions that you're asking, by the way. These are things that you're like, well, why didn't she just get help? Why didn't she just, you know, do this, do that? And the answer is that she did. She actually, during those 10 years, was probably sober. I mean, if I had to guess, I would say a third of the time, and two thirds was battling. But even when she was sober, even if you get into a sober house or a halfway house, at that time, and even what's available now is still limited, but at that time, I mean, there was nothing around here where we lived. So that required travel. And when you've had your license suspended or your car has been, you know, in an accident or lost, you're dependent on other people to drive you hours each way or to visit you or send you things. They were extremely poorly run at the time, meaning dirty, dangerous, not someplace you would ever want to sleep at night, never mind be alone there. And she still, despite all of that, went to countless of them in an attempt to get clean, countless. Some of them have been closed down since then. Some of them are still up and running. Many, many, many have opened since then in remembrance of other people, from people that have been lost along the way, and their families, you know, go and do nonprofits and open them up. But they are not what people think they are. They're very difficult to find. They're hard to get into. They're hard to pay for. And when it's a brand new disease, as that was, and there's no cure, there is no cure. It's learning to live with it and learning to not let it take your life. That is something that we were kind of fumbling over ourselves, trying to figure out, how do we even help her with this, because we don't know the answer.
Did you come up with ways that you could watch for problems? Or
We tried. Yep. So she was back and forth at the house for quite a few years. Back and forth, and it was a lot of help, you know, for everyone. And what we eventually came up with as a family, after many traumatic events, was that we couldn't save her. She had to save herself. And she was very understanding of that when we would talk to her. Of course, there were times when she was very angry, very upset, you know, don't
Sure.
desert me, don't leave me. She wanted to blame. She was human, you know. But
Well,
we
did
decided
you?
that we had to stay together. We had to stick
Right.
together with it.
Right. But and you had did you learn things to watch out for, signs that things were
Oh,
going
yeah.
wrong? I mean, things you
Oh,
could
yeah.
say to somebody now, this is what, if you see this happening to your family member, be aware, do what you can, you know.
Yeah, I mean, aside from, you know, the obvious things that we learned about what it looks like when someone's nodding off, when they're sitting at the dinner table, there's the things like extra phones all of a sudden being around because they have more than one phone line and they don't want you to go through their phone. The track marks, you know, it's obvious when they're on their arms, but you have to check in between their toes, their feet, you know, behind their ears and their head and just all these horrible places. But especially going back to what I was saying, when they're female, especially, things turning up like gifts. Oh, that was a gift. Where'd you get this necklace? Where'd you get this bag? Where'd you know, things that just don't make sense. Things like that, that in your mind you're like, am I going crazy? Am I a match? Am I being mean? Am I, you know, harping on them? The biggest thing I can say to watch out for is them disappearing. You don't know where they are for a half an hour. They say they're going to the bathroom. Now you can't find them. It's been 40 minutes. Those things like that, and they make you feel crazy. They make you feel crazy. And it's reasons like that that the fighting starts to take place at home, that the whole home is disrupted. And that's when you have to have really strong boundaries. I love you, but this behavior cannot happen here. You know, there were some times that were really, violent when things escalated, when we had to do what we had to do for her. And those drugs have an extremely powerful grip on you. And I can tell you, I've met some people that suffer from this that are not nice people. They have completely lost themselves, or maybe they weren't good people to begin with. I don't know. And then I've met some people that were truly tragic to see them in that condition, that would beg for mercy, that would beg to be better. They did not want to be like that. They knew they were losing their life. And she was one of those people. She did not want to live that life. And she said that a million times.
So are they learning? I mean, is the situation better to some extent as we become more knowledgeable? Are people, our patients, I'll call them patients for lack of a better word, learning better ways to cope and deal with it?
Think we still have so far to go. I would love to say yes to all of that. I think that the best answer I can give you is yes, because we do know some things that need to be done. We've identified them, but no, because we're still so far away from actually being able to make them a reality. You know,
How long ago did your sister pass?
she passed almost 10 years ago. It'll be her 10-year anniversary this August.
Oh wow. Okay. And she wrote, I mean, as you mentioned, she had left volumes of
Oh,
journals
yeah.
and things like that.
Yep.
Did she, and she was writing about this situation.
Oh, yeah. She felt like she had already lost herself. And I remember her saying things like, "Please don't forget me." And I was like, "What?" And she was like, "Just don't forget me. Don't forget me." And she'd be looking at me, and I'm like, "I know it's you. I know it's you in there." And she'd be like, "No, Katie, don't forget me." And like when you have someone who loves, you know, they love you and you love them. This is my little sister. I slept with her every night growing up. We were both terrified of the dark. This is my person. And I'm like, don't say these things because you're like, I don't want to hear this. But then you have to remember, what must she be going through to say that? Don't forget me. I'll never forget you. I'll never forget you.
So what kind of things did she write about? What you have a couple examples of the things
I
she would
do, sure.
say?
Yep. I'm gonna read you. I know that I think I have sent you one, but I'm actually gonna read you that one and another one if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Because yeah, I think that this one is just really worth going over and she had written it. She had written them both when she was in a really bad place. So I just want to, I know right about where it is here. Let me just check this edition. So she wrote this about trying to stay clean. It goes like this. If I could just live by their mottos, my life would be just fine. Let go and let God in one day at a time. I've got a devil on my left shoulder and an angel on my right. I need to shake the devil off of me, and I try with all my might. But it's not going to be easy. Of this I am quite sure. For this disease that I am up against isn't known to have a cure. My love affair with this poison has made a prisoner of me. I've tried to run so many times, but it just won't set me free. My guilt haunts my dreams. My heart is filled with shame. I'm always looking for excuses instead of taking any blame. At first, I loved the thrill. I was a fool for the euphoric charms, but I turned into a monster, sticking needles in my arms. Friends and family always wondering, will I ever be saved? Never satisfied with my performance or the way that I behaved. I've missed so much time. I hope I can make it up to them now, but I'm unsure they even want me to, and unsure that I know how. If they say that life's a gift, then mine is yet to be unwrapped. I have to search my soul for the real me and try to bring her back. I want to stay clean this time, and I'll try so very hard, but it's hard to leave it all behind me when I'm living with these scars. There's never enough sorries I could say, no way to change the past. I'm chasing demons from my head and praying for peace at last. So that was one of the ones that she had just kind of sent to us, like to try and make us understand what she was going through. Mm-hmm. And then after she passed away, this is another one that my mom found kind of just blowing around on the living room floor that none of us had ever read before. And it's called The Ones I Love. The ones I love have watched me leave. The ones I love now have to grieve. Their beautiful faces streak with tears as they mourn my lost years. The ones I love have had enough. They're tired of watching me kill myself. And in death, there is only truth. They read the pages of my misspent youth. The ones I love have seen my soul. They've watched me slowly lose control. The ones I love believed in me, even as my addiction had me on my knees. So many times they watched me fall, but they never lost faith in spite of it all. The ones I loved watched me hide because I felt so ugly inside. I hope they realize I always cared. I never meant to make them scared. The ones I loved had to set me free because all of my misery wanted company. It was almost as if they didn't want to see that there was no resemblance of the girl I used to be. The ones I love will all eventually die, but I went first, and so they cry. As they stare into my lifeless eyes, I wish I could have said goodbye to the ones I love.
Hmm. Oh, that had to tear you apart.
Yeah, it really did, because she felt like she was gone already before she even died. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that you would all be feeling it later. But what a tragic, you know, poem to that is your memory, your final memory of her.
It was just terrible. It just to see someone who had so much ambition and so much drive and so much to offer the world crumble in that state was just, you know, I was at work a couple nights and she was dropped off there at least twice. And to see someone in that state, a lot of people have never seen anyone in that state. And the people that have, I'm sure would agree, it's something you don't ever want to see because they aren't themselves. And what these drugs do to your brain is completely change the way you respond to things. And it rewires your need and your satisfaction drive. So the way that most people feel an internal need for food, water, shelter, love, safety, it takes over for all that. And that's why people are able to steal from their parents, hurt their spouses, you know, do things to their children that they wouldn't normally do that compromise their safety, things like that, because they're not thinking the way the rest of us think anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's the scary, scary truth of it. So when you think about having to undo that, correct that behavior, relearn the basics of life, and then on top of it, deal with a physical dependency, I mean, that's a huge undertaking for anybody. It's huge. It's almost overwhelming. Like, how would you even start doing that? And then we tell people on top of, and you've lost your job, you know, and you can't drive a car anymore, and your house is in foreclosure, you know, all these things that are going on. It's like, what is even the point? And that's how they feel. They feel so down.
So
yeah, so lost. And
these are sin dictated, you know, sin Synthetic drugs, correct?
Well, now it's the fentanyl. The fentanyl now is the big thing that's getting everybody because it's so deadly. But yes, there are synthetic drugs, and there's still the oxys, the Percocets, the heroin, you know, all that stuff.
Are,
is still out
are
there
the synthetic
as well.
Drugs worse?
I mean, I can't really answer that. I don't know. And I know they're worse for us in the medical community because we don't know what we're dealing with and we don't know how to treat it.
I've just had this flash of a thought, you know, when we went through this entire COVID disaster, and that was a manufactured disease in which the more deadly it was, the better for somebody. Who manufactured it. And if you're going to create a drug crisis and destroy people's lives the way you've just discussed, it's like to create a drug that is synthetic and is, and that's exactly why it was created. You know, just, it's frightening to even think that people would intentionally do such a thing.
Of course it is. And that's why, you know, there's all these lawsuits that happened a few years back, and we're lucky that, you know, our state of Massachusetts and the town that we live in has been so wonderful throughout this. They really have been a front runner. And I just went to a meeting last week because Plymouth was finally awarded some of the money from the lawsuits that we won against some of the pharmaceutical companies and CVS and Wal, you know, some drug stores that were named. And they now have to pay some retribution for not doing their due diligence or their direct or indirect involvement. And to know that there are communities that are willing to take this and are like, what does the community think we should do with this? Where is the biggest need? How do we help people the most? That's wonderful. I mean, that again, it's never been done before. These are groundbreaking efforts to try and reach out and help people where the help is needed.
Are they making recommendations? Are they making recommendations, for example, for what you know, what you should have on hand, how you can be prepared, what, you know, things they've learned in the process they can now feed out to the populace?
Oh my gosh!
Or to other doctors.
So Narcan is the number one thing. Anybody who, you know, I have teenagers in my house, so I have Narcan in my house. If I just had regular visitors in my house as a nurse, I know enough to know you have no idea what people are battling or what they're just even dealing with in their own private life. The drugs that are out there right now, anybody could think they're getting anything, you know, and it could be fentanyl or it could be any other synthetic drug or something. So everyone is encouraged to keep Narcan in their house. It's a nasal spray. It's quick and easy to use. A lot of pharmacies give it out for free, which is wonderful. A lot of recovery centers give it out for free. You just have to go and ask for it. I know in Plymouth, we have the Plymouth Recovery Center that was opened, which is wonderful, and they keep it right there on hand for anyone who needs it. You can just take it home. If someone, you know, goes into respiratory distress, or if you give them Narcan, it's not going to hurt them, but if it's from an opiate, it is going to reverse that. So that's a good thing to have on hand. You know, everyone should know the basics, like how to call 911, how to do basic CPR until help gets there, things like that. But I think just being aware that this stuff is out there. If you see something, say something. It's that simple. I know in other parts of the country it's worse than it is here, and I know in other parts of the country it's better. So, but I do also know that it's all over the country. It's everywhere. And it does not discriminate. There are professionals that are in recovery, that are actively using, that are going into rehab and coming back out. I mean, it's mothers, fathers, it's everybody nowadays. So, you know, we're going into 20 years of this. We've gone into a whole other generation. Yeah, I mean, it's really that widespread. And don't forget about our elderly population. We have a lot of elderly people that are now years deep on these medications, and they can't stop taking them without withdrawing. And it may have started with, you know, a knee replacement or an injury or some surgery they had. But we know that that's true as well. So we have to watch not only for them, but also for the other people who go to their house and have access to those medications.
Hadn't thought of that impact of it. Wow. That's pretty intense.
Yeah.
So where do you want this book to go? What do you want to see happen to it?
I would love to see the book get into more schools. I know that I said Plymouth was great, and we had a lot of really good meetings before proms and things like that with kids and sharing the story and how they need to be aware. And, you know, one bad decision can change the entire rest of not only your life, but everyone who loves and cares about you as well. So I would love to see more education with young people. We've done a lot with recovery too, as well. Recovery, prisons, women's groups, pretty much everybody. I mean, it really just affects everyone. I don't think that I know anyone, not one person, who hasn't been either directly or indirectly, meaning in their immediate family, affected.
Hmm.
No one.
That's so frightening to even contemplate.
It's terrifying, and I'm going to be very raw and honest. This scares me more than anything when it comes to my children, more than anything,
than
a car accident, more than cancer, more than anything, because I can somewhat predict those outcomes as a medical professional. I can somewhat brace for the impact, but what I will never be able to brace for is seeing them completely turn into someone else. Losing
yes.
someone while they're still alive is the most terrifying thing.
Of all. Well, it's also interesting to me. I mean, my daughter has a son who's college age now,
mm-hmm.
and he's, you know, it's spring break time. And spring
right.
break has always been an insane time of year. But
mm-hmm.
what do you do in our current situation where people are, you know, so exposed to danger and they're drinking, they're partying, and they're not paying attention to what's going on? How do you cope with that? And it's very, you know, you don't want to stop them from having a good time and enjoying,
right.
you know, a vacation, you know, down at the beach. But it's definitely, you know, what do you, and that concept of having Narcan with you, having parents go as chaperones, not to tell them where to go or not to go, but to be there if something bad happens so they can give them race over and give them a dose of Narcan.
I think even just the kids carrying it, honestly,
mm-hmm.
like however you're going to get it there is fine. But there's a couple of different like branches off of that tree. Number one is education. And we know that, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So
mm-hmm.
just planting those little seeds along the way, like, hey, you know, I really love you. And before you make that decision, before you accept that medication, you know, really think about it. Let my face flash before you because I love you. And we're all going down together if you go down. So I think just, you know, always kind of constantly bringing it up. And along that same branch is also just always bringing it up. There's a lot of families out there still that are like, well, we don't talk about things like that. Well, you should. You should. Because this is not something that's going to go away. This is something that the kids do become aware of far younger than I would like to admit. They do. They have friends with parents who might be using, you know, kids go on sleepovers. Do you really know what's happening at that house?
Mm.
Because there's a lot of things out there now that are very different than when we were kids. And I think taking away the stigma attached to that doesn't mean those parents are bad parents. They might be excellent parents. It just means that there's something that we just need to be aware of. That's all, you know. And no one has to disclose that information. No one has to share that's their private medical information. But I think that kids just knowing, you know, if something doesn't feel right or if someone looks like they're having trouble breathing or if someone's been in the bathroom with the door locked for way too long, maybe I need to call mom and dad and maybe I need to go home. Just something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we were little, we used to have those like stranger danger conversations and stuff. And it's the same thing. It's just evolved with the times. This
yes.
is just the way life
wow.
is now.
It's pretty spooky. And,
know.
You know, there's no
it
way
is.
Around it. You can't
mm-hmm.
escape it. It's happening. So
it is happening.
So if people want to speak with you or, you know, and maybe have you come and do a presentation for them, are you open to that?
Sure. Of course. I love doing stuff like that. I think that that's just part of breaking down those stigmas, you know, and having
and
the
conversation. How would they reach you?
They can reach me on my email. That's probably the best way. It's nursekatier@gmail.com.
And Katie is IE rather than Y?
IE, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if somebody wanted to, you know, this has potential to be a movie. I mean, it's very dramatic and, you know, it has that Days of Wine and Roses feeling as you watch someone fall off a cliff because of alcohol, but this time it's drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of movies do draw people in and communicate or educate a great deal. If somebody had that kind of saw that vision for it, is that something you'd also be open to exploring?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Oh, I'd love to, you know, like I said, this is how we kind of keep her alive and not in that little box in the corner of our room. And she had a lot to say. My sister had a lot to say. And I think that when all she could do was write it down, she was smart enough to do that. And so anything that we can do to help bring her story and her character to life would be amazing.
Well, I really want to thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Catherine, yeah, to remind the audience, we've been speaking with Catherine Morini about her book, The Story of Red Tail Hawk, which is available, let's see, at Amazon. Is it on is it at Barnes & Noble? Any other?
Barnes & Noble, yes.
Mm-hmm, okay. And it's also available in paperback, hardback, and as an ebook.
Yes.
Okay, great. So thank you again for being with us, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
I will hold on to this idea of this book, both saving lives and, you know, making a difference in people's lives in the future, because I think it you come from such a beautiful place of trying to tell this story.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, that's a wrap, everyone. Bye for now. And have a great day.